This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In our first hour today, we will be talking about some of the military history of World War II, and in fact, look back to a battle that many people would argue represented a turning point in the European War. It was the battle for Moscow. And certainly one thing that people don't argue about, it's indisputable, this was the largest battle between two armies of all time. If you combine the totals for both sides, something in the neighborhood of 7 million troops were involved in some part of the battle. And of those 7 million, 2.5 million were killed, taken prisoner, were missing, or wounded badly enough to require hospitalization. The losses on the Soviet side were much heavier than they were on the German side. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the Battle of Moscow with Andrew Nagorsky. He is senior editor at Newsweek International. He is an award-winning Newsweek bureau chief and has been in Moscow and Berlin and several other postings. And he is the author of a new book that's titled The Greatest Battle, Stalin, Hitler, and the Desperate Struggle for Moscow That Changed the Course of World War II. Simon & Schuster is the publisher of the book. Mr. Nagorsky, hello.
Hello, David. Very good to talk to you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. As far as the Germans were concerned here, Hitler believed that if he could capture the city of Moscow, that the Soviet Union would fall.
Yes, he basically believed that he had the illusion that he would march into the Soviet Union, and he attacked in June of 1941. And he thought that even before the weather started turning cold, they could score a victory, which accounts for the fact that he sent in his troops without winter uniforms, which would prove to be one of many terrible mistakes. But if he felt if he could go to Moscow, get as far as Moscow, really have European Russia under his control, and sort of the hub of Russia, which was Moscow, which was the transportation hub, the political capital, of course, all these things that, and in a big industrial center, then even if much of the rest of Russian territory would still not be formally under German control, then in effect the country would be defeated.
And it probably is the case that if he had managed to capture Moscow, that would have been true.
Yeah, well, you get different readings on that. I think you have to remember that one thing that the Russians did do well was begin to evacuate after the disastrous start of the war. Stalin made huge mistakes himself. First of all, he didn't expect Hitler to invade. When he did, he totally disregarded all the intelligence telling him that would happen. Once he did invade, they began to organize the evacuation of the government, of key industries, and there are the standard Russian line is usually, well, we would have won anyway. It might have been a little tougher, but I've also talked to Russian historians who say no, we could have lost the war in that case. I think at the very least one can say, you know, this is what if history. You can never say anything definitively, but I think the closest definitive thing one can say is that if Moscow had been lost, World War II would have lasted much longer than it did, and it was a long war, and not only for the Russians and the Germans, but that would have meant for the Americans, the Brits, everybody else involved.
Yeah. I think that probably for a lot of people, if you think about important battles during World War II that were fought on Soviet soil, the first thing that a lot of people will think of is Stalingrad.
Absolutely.
Which you mentioned in the book, and certainly that was significant, and it was a very large battle, and it involved a lot of people. But the battle for Moscow was bigger, and in the book, in the introduction, you say that it is the case that this battle has largely been forgotten, something that obviously you're trying to address with the book. So the question is, why is it that this battle, arguably more important, hasn't gotten the attention that, for example, that Stalingrad has?
Yeah, very good question. First of all, just to put things in perspective, as you mentioned in your introduction, the Battle for Moscow, which involved about 7 million troops over the approximately 200 days or about 6 months of this battle, was twice the size of the Battle of Stalingrad in terms of number of twice the number of troops involved, more than twice the casualties. In that sense, it was bigger. You can say Stalingrad was a more decisive Soviet victory. In Moscow, you had a situation where the Germans came close to winning, but then fell short, and Stalin managed to Soviet army managed to hold them off in the end for some all sorts of reasons we can finally discuss. But the reason I discovered that I concluded that Moscow has been underplayed is because it doesn't fit into neatly the kind of a sanitized version of what the Russians call the Great Patriotic War. In that version, Stalin rallied the Soviet people, everybody rose up as one, and they fought back. Well, during that initial battle for Moscow, when the Germans, early in the German invasion, many people did not believe in victory. Large numbers of troops initially surrendered. Stalin began ordering the shooting of his own troops who tried to retreat. And there was a great deal of panic in Moscow when it looked like the Germans were about to take the city. It's hard to imagine here in Stalin's Soviet Union that when in October of 1941, when the German troops were very close, there were people who were looting, who were going on strike, who were the KGB was burning its documents. There was chaos in the city. All of that is at odds with that sense of that official version of history, and that's why I think even though this was the first time the German land army had been stopped, the Blitzkrieg had been stopped, it was such a near thing, and showed all the failings of Stalin's leadership in that early part of the war, that I think they much prefer to talk about Stalingrad, which was a more clear-cut victory. They didn't have so many things to sort of sweep under the rug. Mm.
And I think probably an important point to make about all of this, particularly about Operation Barbarossa, which was what the Germans called the invasion of Russia, and the Russian response was that Hitler and Stalin themselves personally were responsible for making all of the big decisions, and on both sides made mistakes that severely disadvantaged their side.
Absolutely. In this sense, they were very much alike. They both thought themselves as far smarter than their generals and would second guess them, often to the detriment of their own men. And both of these tyrants, of course, had no regard for human life. Of their own, I'm not talking about of the enemy, of their own soldiers. And as a result, the fatalities were incredible. As I mentioned, here's Hitler sending his troops into Russia without winter uniforms. Stalin, because of his poor planning and refusal to believe the intelligence, ends up sending up a lot of his troops into those first battles without guns. There'd be troops where units where there'd only be a few guns for every sometimes as little as one gun for 10 men, and they would be instructed, go out there, and when the guy with the gun gets shot, and if you're still alive, pick up the gun. It's just unbelievable at these firsthand accounts of what you hear about what they went through, and then you begin to understand how these casualties could have been so astronomical.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Andrew Nagorsky. He's a senior editor at Newsweek International, also has served as bureau chief for Newsweek in Moscow and Berlin and several other places. His new book is about the battle for Moscow in World War II. The title is The Greatest Battle, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just to take a step back for a moment and talk a little bit about the run-up to the war. In August 1939, Germany and the Soviet Union signed a non-aggression pact. In fact, it seemed very clear that Hitler and Stalin neither trusted the other. Did they think that this was anything more than just temporary?
I think Hitler certainly thought of it only as temporary. It's interesting. I mean, they were both hated each other, distrusted each other, but also had a morbid fascination with each other, especially with their more brutal tendencies. Hitler at times would marvel at at Stalin's purges in the late 1930s and how many hundreds of thousands of people of his own people he killed. Stalin would sometimes marvel at Hitler's, what was called the Night of the Long Knives in the early 1930s, when he killed many of his own associates, anyone he saw as a potential rival. But I think all you have to do is read Mein Kampf, and you see that from the very beginning, Hitler had this idea that he had to conquer Russia. This was the great expanse to the east, the Lebensraum, the area for Germans to expand, to get raw materials. Stalin, I think, managed to convince himself that this alliance would, at the very least, last longer than it did. And because, first of all, his country was so, he had prepared his country so poorly for a war. And then, as I mentioned, he was getting intelligence from his best spies all across Europe that the Germans were about to invade, from the U.S. government, the British government, and he just refused to believe it. He was a classic paranoid. So if everybody's telling me one thing, it must be all a plot to deceive me. And as a result, he didn't allow his troops to go on alert. He didn't allow his soldiers to do anything that was, which was deemed provocative. They didn't even protest much when German overflights were all across the border, and they were using lame excuses that these were inexperienced pilots who were in training. So he just allowed his armies to be completely blindsided by the Germans.
Yeah, that's a remarkable part of the story, that Stalin, in the face of what he was being told by his military intelligence and the information he was getting from the Western powers, virtually up to the day before the German invasion, he was still getting this message. People were trying to say, look, the Germans are going to invade, and we need to be ready to face that. And virtually up to the very last minute, he was saying, "No, I don't want to hear about that. Don't tell me that. That's wrong."
Not only that, was he in those last hours, last day or two, there were at least three German defectors. You know, the Germans had all these troops deployed along the border, and there were at least three Germans who came across to the Soviet side and looked and said, "Look, we're about to attack the next day." One of them was a German communist, from a young man from Berlin. And so what does Stalin do? Instead of say, "Thanks for warning us," he orders that this guy be shot as a provocateur. You can't make this stuff up.
How long after the non-aggression pact was signed did Germany start actually to plan Operation Barbarossa?
Oh, it was certainly by 1940 the decision had been made. So we're talking a period, you know, the non-aggression pact lasted approximately 20 months. Less than halfway through that, the serious planning began. So it was in the works for quite some time, and the top brass knew about it. And Hitler, it's interesting, with his generals had been very wary of a lot of Hitler's earlier moves against Czechoslovakia, then, of course, with Poland, then into Western Europe. And each time it seemed like Hitler proved them their worries wrong because the Germans scored very quick victories. So by the time Hitler said, "We're taking on Russia," even though some of the generals had misgivings, they were very, it was very difficult to stand up to Hitler in any case. People were afraid to. But also, some of them were having some doubts and saying, "Well, Hitler proved right on all these other things. We thought we couldn't do this quickly and this easily." The French collapsed so quickly, for instance, in the West. Maybe he's right on Russia. But there was no stopping him.
Well, certainly, as far as the Germans were concerned, the key to success was speed.
Yeah,
it was the Operation Barbarossa was launched in June of 1941, and they believed that they could be in Moscow in 4 months, which would have
even earlier. Probably.
Even so, that would have got them around the problem of the Russian winter. And in fact, initially, they just tore through Russia. I think in the book you mentioned the fact that the Germans advanced 450 miles in the first month.
Yeah,
and then by the beginning of September, if I calculate right looking at the map, that looks like they were maybe about 200 miles
right.
from Moscow. So it's a very, very strong initial success. And then they started to get bogged down, even though eventually they got to within about 60 miles, I think.
Yeah, some units, advanced units, were probably even within about 25 miles. You know, it's interesting. I mean, there are two things. I mean, this timing question is fascinating because basically you can talk about Hitler's mistakes and Stalin's mistakes, and it's almost like there's this bidding war. Who could be the most stupid dictator and military leader? Because and we can talk about Stalin's mistakes later, but we talked about one of them, mainly the lack of preparation. But with Hitler, first of all, he was going to launch his attack on the Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa, a month earlier than he did. He was going to do it in May of 1941. Then he postpones it because they have problems in the Balkans and send some troops there. So he launches this attack June 22nd, 1941, which is 129 years to the day that Napoleon invaded Russia in 1812. You'd say, well, maybe there's a lesson there. But Hitler was convinced he could still do it, and he might have succeeded. But they go straight west, straight east, I'm sorry, towards Moscow. And as you say, they're within 200, 230 miles in the Smolensk region, and already by late July. And at that point, instead of his generals are saying, let's keep going, we can now deal this blow to Moscow and really, really have the situation under control. And Hitler begins to dither. It's almost like he's a little bit of afraid of Moscow. And then he says to his generals, no, we've got to go south first to Kiev and the Ukraine, because that's the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. We've got to take that and only then go to Moscow. So he diverts his troops south. They have a victory there. But it's very costly, and first of all, it eats up a lot of time. So by the time they start the attack on Moscow, which is officially September 30th, 41, first you have what's called the mud season, when the rains turn these Russian roads into swamps. So equipment, men get bogged down, and then very quickly, even by Russian standards, a very harsh winter. And that begins to change the situation dramatically.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here, someone who's been waiting patiently. I want to bring them into the conversation. Someone in Effingham. We'll go right there on our toll-free line four.
Oh, hello? I just got one question. If you thought Hitler would have just worried about Russia very first before he went anywhere else, you think France and England and everybody else would have did anything about it because they were sort of afraid of communism too?
Well, at that point, remember, Hitler has already conquered. Are you saying would
yeah,
should he have attacked
he even
first
went to
before
France
he
or,
went west?
Yeah.
Well, I think Hitler's strategy was the following. He thought, let's by having this non-aggression pact with Stalin, that gave him the green light to launch World War II. And remember, then Stalin and Hitler divide up Poland. Hitler invades Poland from the west. Stalin invades Poland from the east. They divide it up. And so that sort of secures Poland for Hitler, which was a high priority. And then he feels he's got a free hand. His thinking was, first, I deal with the west. And he manages to conquer almost all of Western Europe. He doesn't succeed in getting Britain. And there were some of his generals saying, you've got to defeat Britain first before turning towards Russia. Instead, when he bogs down and he can't, the Battle of Britain, the air war over Britain goes against him, he decides, well, now if I attack Russia and get control of Russia, then I'll be able to turn against the rest of the West, which means Britain, and if it involves the United States, so be it. And his thinking went in that direction. I don't think his ambitions were so grandiose that Russia would not have been enough for Hitler. So tactically, that's the course he chose.
Okay, I was just wondering, like, if England and France would have went against him if he just went.
Well, remember when he invaded Poland. Then England and France did declare war against Russia, against Germany, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but why didn't they declare war against Russia, too, then?
Well, at that point, they had an alliance with Poland, and felt they had to do it, adhere to it. And Churchill's thought was, I may hate the Soviet Union, I may hate Stalin's system, but I'm hoping that eventually they'll join in this fight against Germany, because he saw them as the bigger threat at that moment than the Soviet Union.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Andrew Nagorski. He's a senior editor at Newsweek International and is the author of the recent book, The Greatest Battle. It's about the battle for Moscow during World War II, one that was, a lot of people would argue, was very important, and in fact might well have been a turning point in the European War. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. One of the things that, you know, if we again line up bad decisions on the German side, obviously there were some big ones, including delays along the way, including the decision to take Ukraine and rather than just driving on to Moscow. Also, one of the things that the Germans did was that in the territory that they moved through, they dealt to put it mildly, very harshly with the people there who initially had greeted the Germans as liberators because Stalin had treated them so badly. How long did that last? And then did resistance from not people who were official combatants, but people who were living in the areas that the Germans moved through, was that important in slowing the Germans down?
That was a key factor. And again, as you're exactly right, that was a major, major miscalculation, because here, you know, you've got to think of this is a region, the Western Soviet Union, where Stalin's policies has led to the deaths of millions of people by executions, mass starvation, the Gulag. And so when Hitler's armies invade, lots of people who have no idea yet what Hitler and the Nazi movement represented think, can it be any worse? In fact, maybe it's better. And so they are at first willing, many troops are willing to surrender, for instance. That's where, when you have the big surrendering of Russian troops, because they think, well, you know, it's a lost cause, and better to survive by surrendering. Well, what the troops began to discover, and word soon spread, that if you surrendered to the Germans, your chances of survival weren't high at all, because you could be either executed or simply starved or mistreated to such an extent that it made no sense. And Hitler had this idea that he would treat these people, anybody in his domain, as subjects to be, you know, as vassals. Of course, he immediately started sending in execution squads to kill Jews, but also anybody who was a political commissar, which was a political officer in the Russian army, was marked for execution in defiance of all ideas about, you know, surrendering in war. And so if you were, for instance, a political commissar in a Russian military unit, and you know that if you were captured, you'd be shot, you were going to do anything to make your men fight back. So it's I think one of the great what-ifs of history is, if the Nazis had, you know, for purely tactical reasons, adopted more humane policies in the beginning just to subjugate or gain control, would the resistance have been what it began to be? So with the combination of German terror and then, of course, Stalin using terror against his own people if they didn't resist, he warned them that anybody who was imprisoned by the Germans wouldn't be considered a POW but as a traitor, and that even their families could suffer the consequences. All that began to change the situation. People felt that often they had nothing to lose, but when they tried to fight back.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else, someone on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello, gentlemen. I just wanted to know, what was General Guderian's role in the campaign?
Very good question. General Heinz Guderian, for those of your listeners who don't know, was the famed German tank commander who had been very effective in the other campaigns, in France in particular. And he was one of the key tank commanders who was put, he was really urging Hitler to drive to Moscow and to score a quick victory there. He was more gutsy than most of his other commanders in at least arguing with Hitler.
And Hitler divided his army into three main groups, and one went north, one was in the center, and one went south?
Yes, yes. And Guderian was part of that army group center, which was whose job was to head for Moscow. And then when Hitler said, "No, you got to go south first," Guderian was appalled, and he tried to fight that decision, but to no avail. He was extremely frustrated. He was extremely angry with the planners. He kept appealing, for instance, for winter uniforms for his troops, and he couldn't get them. And you read his accounts of that period, his memoirs, and it's just, you see the frustration just pouring out, feeling that his men are being killed and losing this battle needlessly when it was a battle that could have been won. And another factor that really demoralized Guderian and other German generals was that when Hitler delayed his approach to Moscow, that gave Stalin the chance to call back Soviet troops that were deployed in Siberia in the Soviet Far East. Until that time, he had been afraid that Japan might, which was allied with Hitler, might attack Russia from that side, from the east. And finally, a very well-known spy, Richard Sorge in Tokyo, was able to provide him with the information that the Japanese were not going to attack in the east. In fact, they were equipping their troops with tropical shorts, which meant they were going to Southeast Asia, and of course later would become involved in the fights with Americans and Brits there. So these units were brought back from Siberia, who were well-equipped for the winter, well-dressed, and then when they began to meet General Guderian's units and others, that was really a blow to the Germans.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This plan, as you say, the initial German invasion plan split the forces into three. The one force in the north went up into the Baltics. One force in the south went down into Ukraine. The one in the center, which was the one that I think was best equipped, had the most experienced troops. There, the mission was drive on straight to Moscow. If they had not spread their troops over such a wide spread of territory and had perhaps concentrated them a little bit more, there still was the possibility that they could be flanked, I suppose. Maybe that's what they were thinking about, that they'd have to control as much territory as possible. But if they had concentrated their forces a little bit more in the center, do military historians think that that would have made much difference?
Well, I think there was a need, as you say, to watch the flanks. There was a need to, they did feel they wanted to get other places, were trying to get Leningrad as well. They were putting pressure on various points, but I think my feeling was from having what I learned about that period was that if they had used that army group center more effectively and had not gone south to Kiev first, I think they probably would have taken Moscow, and then they could have. That would have also cut a lot of the transportation lines for the Soviets, and it would have made it easier for them then to knock off places like the Ukraine. So I don't think they needed even to get all of their troops, although some of the troops from Army Group North and from Army Group South were supposed to sort of hook around and reinforce the ring around Moscow. I think it wouldn't have required a major redeployment of those troops, but more a better strategy for the use of the troops that they did have.
Well, let's talk again with another caller. This is someone in Rantoul, line one.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. That's utterly fascinating because I was recently given a book entitled The Service, The Memoirs of General Reinhard Galen, translated by David Irving. Are you familiar with that book?
I've seen that. Yeah, yes. I know of that book. Yes, yes.
It goes right along with what you said. Now, this, you know who Reinhard Gehlen was?
Yeah. He was, yeah, go ahead.
He was general of the intelligence services of the East for the Nazis, and he,
right.
he defected at the end of the war. He hid and developed a new West German intelligence organization. In fact, part of that is still called the Gehlen Group today. And this is a detailed book mm-hmm. but on Stalingrad and the other things. He talks about how General, his agents said that General Stalin was absolutely stunned for several 3 days when Hitler attacked. He actually didn't believe that he was going to attack.
Right.
He actually thought there was.
And he may, according to some accounts, which I, some of the eyewitnesses, he had what appears to be close to a psychological breakdown there.
That's
when, after the Germans attacked, he retreated to his dacha and just didn't want to. He wouldn't address the nation. He wouldn't do anything to really step up. And initially, he thought maybe this would be a case of. Where he might even be deposed by his own Politburo because he had failed so miserably.
Well, he goes into details on how they calculated the strength, the reserves, capable of what reserves it could have based on normal percentages based on population.
Mm-hmm.
He was investigating the raw material situation, the growing signs that Stalingrad could be a returning point, and he talked about his bitterness of his warnings of intelligence. He really addressed Hitler personally. He didn't want to. He always had an in-between.
Mm-hmm.
A few times, Hitler just was not listening to him. And then eventually, they felt that there was an inside man giving up intelligence, and they felt that was Martin Bormann.
Mm-hmm.
If I would have known a little more that I'd be listening to you today, I would have gone into this book and pulled out some more information.
Mm-hmm.
This book is a truly amazing book.
Yes, yeah. Well,
what's more amazing is this is a personal copy of a former intelligence agent operating on United Nations Security Council Strategic Arms Veneration Enactment 40 years ago,
mm-hmm.
who has been in the business.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of fascinating firsthand accounts in researching my own book. Aside from interviewing a great number of people who still are alive, you know, are obviously quite elderly, or sometimes the children of top military and political leaders, some of the old memoirs of that period, both on the German and the Russian side, are fascinating, and this is certainly one of them.
Again, I want to thank the caller. We have somebody else I want to get right to, and since we're moving into our last 15 minutes, also we'd like to introduce again our guest, Andrew Nagorski. He is a senior editor at Newsweek International, an award-winning Newsweek bureau chief in Moscow, Berlin, and several other places. He's the author of a number of books, and his most recent is about the battle for Moscow in World War II. The title is The Greatest Battle, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. We have another caller here, someone in Stell. This is our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I recently saw a program on the History Channel which explained Hitler's skewed judgments so often. I've wondered my whole life, you know, how could he be making these mistakes that were so huge, and his officers were all, as you said, upset about it, and it's because, and this information was taken from diaries of the men around him, and his medical doctor had to give him a shot every morning before he could get out of bed, which contained methamphetamines. He just didn't have the energy to get out of bed until he got this shot, and then for years he could be energetic and go about his business, but toward the end it began affecting his system so much that he developed Parkinson's disease, and they showed clips where you could see his left hand trembling, and it was always hidden. It was never out, you know, shaking hands and things like that. But I found this most interesting that explains a lot of the insanity of war making in history is that the people who make the war are so insane, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's, of course, Hitler as a study in personality. There's so much that one, that's a big subject. The question that's also, that's always the most morbidly fascinating is, though, why did so many people follow him? You know, it's one thing to have somebody who's both brilliant in some ways, but clearly insane in others. But for millions of people to follow him and to do what they did in his name, that's the chilling part.
We talked a little bit about Heinz Guderian, who was one of the top generals on the German side. Maybe you'll tell us a little bit about Georgi Zhukov.
Yes, well, Georgi Zhukov, General Zhukov, who was the top general on the Soviet side, later Marshal Zhukov, was a very tough customer. He was just young enough to have survived Stalin's purges. It was in 1937 and 1938. Stalin had what was called the Great Terror, where basically about 700,000 people were executed, simply shot, including hundreds of top military officials, generals and admirals and others, which is another reason why the Soviet army was so ill-prepared for this invasion, when if you basically decapitate it, and then the people who move up the ranks are often less qualified. Zhukov proved to be a very tough and able military officer. He was in Stalin's mode in the sense that he was willing to sacrifice as many men in any situation as he felt was necessary. He had no qualms about that. But he was also rumored to be some of the people. You know, people were so afraid of Stalin because they knew one wrong word, look, and they could be tortured, executed, or sent to the gulag. That they were a little bit in awe of Zhukov because sometimes he actually disagreed with Stalin or would express views that weren't exactly in line with his. But it was interesting. I met Zhukov, one of Zhukov's daughters, who's still alive. And she told me that this whole idea that Zhukov was always uncowed by Stalin is a bit of a myth, because she said that she remembers when she was a child that whenever Zhukov was home, her mother had packed for Zhukov a little bag with sort of some toiletries and two changes of underwear, just in case the next knock on the door was for him and he was being sent to prison and to meet whatever fate. So he clearly had no illusions about the nature of Stalin, but he was also the person who eventually began to really turn the battle around and would be eventually in charge of the whole Soviet drive against Germany.
Let's again talk with, we have a couple of other callers. Next is Effingham, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I had a little distraction there. perhaps you could explain, your guest could explain, how it occurred that the Russians were so ill-prepared and so stupid and so unqualified to fight in any war that they came forward, and when Pistol Pack and Patton showed up, you know, and lanced through the middle of Germany, and then Americans met the Russians at the Danube. At the Elbe.
Yes.
And then if the incompetence you keep speaking of and the almost animalistic persona of the Russians, and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, the only reason Patton went to the Danube, or the forces met there, they knew the Russians were going to take all of Germany, not just part of it. And I don't think we helped the Russians at any point. The things I've read about it, that the Russian worker finished making his tank, and he got put on his uniform and got in it and started to the front.
Right.
Well, I cannot agree with hardly anything that you have described about we are all collective human beings. And under war conditions, the horrors that you have articulated is universal. And I want to remind you before I ring off that the recent program right here on Channel 12 and the great General Jackson, who when he had part of his troops saying, you can take this war and shove it, lined them up and shot them. And then suddenly this man is a hero and becomes president, and the arc of American intelligence seems to be superior to all on this earth. Now look what we're repeating, the same things that happened during and before World War II and even World War I, and here we are stuck in the Middle East, bombing. Just today's paper.
I think we take the points. Well, I certainly don't think that you were meaning to say that that Russian soldiers were not brave or didn't fight hard.
I describe many acts of bravery in this book.
And I think more your criticism was for the top leadership going to the very top, Stalin himself.
Yes, and remember, I'm talking about the beginning of the war. They did learn from the mistakes of the battle for Moscow. One thing the Soviet Union had going for it, and Stalin had going for it, was an almost limitless supply of manpower, which eventually they put to better use. And a new generation of military commanders did become more effective. And of course, you hear from the different accounts and from many veterans I interviewed. From that period, we really say, well, by about 1943, we really learned how to fight. But that early period and how to really deal with the Germans effectively, that early period had all these costly mistakes, which made those casualties so sky high. There's so many points the caller addressed, but I think, first of all, I think there's a lot of brutality, of course, in any war. But it's one thing to say, yes, there were instances where, for instance, American soldiers were shot for desertion or cowardice. Those were pretty small numbers. During the war, in the Soviet Union, 158,000 Soviet troops were ordered to be executed by their own side. This is a dimension, a size of terror against your own men, which is certainly there's nothing like that in the West. So this is just, you know, have to keep things in perspective. Stalin had been killing literally millions of his own citizens before the war, and Stalin continued his terror during the war. That has to be stressed because as the Germans inflicted their terror on the Soviet Union, Stalin did not stop his own machinery of terror.
Let's talk with someone else. Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Excuse me. I'd like to get your comment. I think the Battle of Moscow might have turned out differently if Stalin hadn't had a spy in the German embassy in Tokyo who informed him that the Japanese had no plans to attack the Russians, that they had other ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Stalin had a whole army in Manchuria waiting. Isn't that true?
Yes. I had mentioned that already. Yes, this spy, Richard Sorge, he was a fascinating...
Well, I'm sorry, I was late.
That's all right. But I'd love to talk about him because he, the spy you're referring to, Richard Sorge, was of German-Russian parentage, so he could pass for a German. He spoke flawless German. And he worked as a German correspondent in Tokyo, was very well informed, got to know top officials, was very friendly with the German embassy, in fact so friendly he was quite a Don Juan. He was conducting affairs with the wife of the German ambassador, with the wives of several top Japanese officials, so he was getting all this inside information, which, as mentioned before, eventually allowed him to assure Stalin that the Japanese were not going to invade. But what's important to remember here is the timing. He couldn't do that till late September. If Hitler had sent his army straight to Moscow, Sergei wouldn't have had time to get that information to confirm it. That delay of Hitler's armies by diverting them south gave Sergei the time to find out and get the signals right.
Yeah, I believe he became a communist. He was wounded in World War I, had a severe chest wound, and was captured.
Yeah.
And was brainwashed.
And what's really interesting is afterwards, shortly after he gave Stalin that information, Stalin despised him because he had been right, for instance, in his earlier predictions that Germany would invade the Soviet Union when it did, and Stalin hated anybody who told him something he didn't want to hear. And he was captured by the Japanese. He was held in prison until 1944. The Japanese had sentenced him to death, but were in no hurry to execute him, and they put out feelers to the Soviet side several times, would you like to do a prisoner exchange? Stalin's response is, we don't know this guy, and they eventually hung him.
We're just, again, to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. We haven't really talked very much about the fighting that took place around the city. You mentioned the fact that there was at one point when German units might have gotten as close as 20 miles. I think that you talked in the book about the fact that there was points where German commanders were close enough so that they could look at the city through their binoculars. They were actually
there was one report of that. It's that sort of unconfirmed. Certainly there were some advance units that were quite close.
What made the difference then? What was it that the Soviet forces were able to do that, given the fact that the Germans had gotten that close, that was as close as they got?
Well, remember that the units that got that close were advance units. By that time, the Germans were, their logistics was breaking down because of the weather, because of their whole move through the south. They were freezing. If you're freezing, you're not ready to advance very far. And they were just exhausted by the fighting and all that they had done up to that point. So as a result, they didn't have the numbers of troops deployed at that point. Or the troops, I remember talking to one Soviet veteran who was watching a German unit across the river, who was saying they outgunned us. It was clear they were, but they were just sitting there, and they clearly didn't want to move. It was so cold, and we were cold, and we find it hard to keep going, but we had better clothing. It wasn't great clothing than they did, and we were used to the Russian winter. Later on, when the Russians finally began counterattacking, when the tide turned, he said they overran places like this and found German bodies stacked like logs, and some of the German soldiers frozen with just peasant shawls wrapped around their ears, anything they could get from the civilian population. So it was simply too little too late.
And I suppose it just not only can you not overestimate the significance of the Russian winter and the Germans not being prepared, but also the fact that the Soviets on their part had the opportunity of these troops. If anybody should be ready to fight in Russian winter, it should be troops from Siberia, so that they could the Soviets could bring them in. They were experienced dealing with it, whether they were well equipped, and it was something that for them was, at least that, was not a problem.
Yes, yeah, they were, you know, they were fresh troops, well dressed. Even if they weren't Siberian themselves, which it doesn't mean that all these troops had grown up in Siberia. Some had, some not, had not, but they'd been deployed there, so they were used to these conditions. So suddenly, that was a huge blow to the Germans to see these fresh troops pouring in.
So here, and perhaps we have about a minute left. As far as the Soviet Union and the Soviet military and the rest of the war goes, what did this experience mean for them?
Well, I think you know, it was basically that they hung on was the most important thing. That they hung on so that they then could begin to regroup and begin the slow process of beginning to push back against the Germans. But I think the fact that to this day Russian accounts often just breeze right over this period. And to this day, Stalin is considered a great war leader. There's actually a quote from a teacher's manual which was published just a couple of years ago in Putin's Russia, which says Stalin was the greatest Soviet leader ever. And they justify this. They sort of acknowledge very vaguely, well, he did some terrible things, but he was a great war leader. What I'm trying to show in this book is in that initial stage of the war, he was a disastrous war leader. And part of the reason why, a big reason why Russia suffered so much during the war was not just Hitler, but Stalin himself.
Yeah. And for you, as well as I'm sure a lot of other scholars, since the fall of the Soviet Union, you've been able to take advantage of access to material that previously nobody outside of Russia could have seen.
Yes, there were many top secret documents that have been declassified from the archives. That was done mostly in the 90s and has been slowly been coming out. Which gives you, there were things like the reports of the censorship office from that day. They were reading letters of citizens, all of which showed that morale was nothing like it was officially portrayed. So I pulled a lot of those accounts and used those in the book as well.
Well, the book that we're talking about is The Greatest Battle. The subtitle is Stalin, Hitler, and the Desperate Struggle for Moscow That Changed the Course of World War II. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. Our guest, the author, is Andrew Nagorsky. He's senior editor at Newsweek International and has been bureau chief for Newsweek in both Moscow and Berlin. Mr. Nagorsky, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting Heir Apparent at 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, April 2nd at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The program features Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, Tower's Fanfare for the Uncommon Woman, and Schickley's Fanfare for the Common Cold. More information is available at 333-6280.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director today for the Afternoon Magazine is Henry Frain. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll rebroadcast an interview with historian and biographer Stacy Cordery. She is the author of Alice Roosevelt Longworth, From White House Princess to Washington Power Broker. That will follow the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look at commodity prices now. Another down day today in Kansas City and in Chicago. May wheat in Kansas City trading at 10:32, down 91. In Chicago, May wheat 9.90 and a quarter, down 83 and three quarters. July 9.72 and a half, down 75 and a half. May corn 5.09, down 18 and a quarter. July 5.20 and a half, down 18 and three quarters. September 5.23, down 18 and a half. December 5.21 and a quarter, down 20. May beans 12.07, down 50. July 12.22, down 50. August 12.16, down 50. November 11.40, down 50. May meal 306.70, down $4. May oil 54.40, down $2. At the Merck in Chicago, April live cattle 90.65, up 102.5. June 91 even, up 105. March feeder cattle 99.10, down 25. April 103.65, up 150. April lean hogs 55.75. That